The road from Athens to Corinth is a delightful one. It skirts down the side of the blue Aegean Sea, cutting through very ancient olive groves and rocky hills. There are only actually 50 miles between Athens and Corinth, these two famous cities. And today, if you're in Greece, you can travel the distance very comfortably by car in less than an hour. I have no doubt it would have taken Paul a little bit longer than that, but still 50 miles must have seemed a small journey in comparison to the sort of trips that he had been familiar with. And it must have been a short distance to separate two places with such a vastly different atmosphere too. Athens was an ancient city, dominated still by the architecture of 400 years before, the classical age. Corinth, on the other hand, was very much a new town, built on the ruins of an older town, but nevertheless a newly erected metropolis. Had nothing like the strong links to the past which Athens possessed. Again, Athens was, in spite of the Roman occupation, very much an independent city, controlled her own affairs. But Corinth had been made the capital of the Roman province of Achaia, and so she had a much more direct contact with the Roman authorities, and was in any case a much more cosmopolitan city. For although Athens was predominantly centered around academic learning, a university town, Corinth, the life of Corinth revolved around trade and industry. The marketplace of Athens was a center of philosophical debate, but the marketplace of Corinth was a center for making money. In fact, if you go to Corinth today, you can still see the little rows of shops that surrounded the city center. It must have been alive with the bustle of commerce. The effect of all this commerce, of course, together with the modernness of the city and the influence of Rome, was that Corinth was a far less stereotyped place in its culture than Athens, far less Greek in a way. It was a cosmopolitan place where many cultures imported through the trade routes collided and interacted. Greeks and Romans and Asians and Alexandrians from North Africa, they all came here. And of course, Jews. They all mingled in this buzzing urban community dedicated to the pursuit of the good life. So at Corinth, Paul wasn't going to experience the kind of deep cross-cultural problems which he'd seen at Athens. The Corinthians were commercial travellers, not academics. Their presuppositions about life and religion weren't going to make a big barrier to them accepting the ideas of the gospel in the way that the philosophers of Athens experienced when Paul was there. Here Paul could hope for some real success in his evangelism. And if a strong nucleus was formed, Corinth would be an ideal center for the spread of the Christian faith to other parts of the Mediterranean Sea. So it would be a center, this place, if Paul could establish it. But evangelism is never easy. And Paul, as we see in this chapter, had his share of disappointment and antagonism in Corinth. Indeed, I think if we had to find a title for this little section we studied today, we might call it The Joys and Sorrows of a Pioneer Missionary. Because on the one hand, Paul experienced great encouragement during his stay in Corinth. But on the other hand, he encountered some of his most bitter rejection and opposition. Well, let's look at those things. There are three aspects of Paul's evangelism that I want us to particularly focus on tonight. The first is his flexibility in verses 1 to 4. The second is his authority in verses 5 to 6. And then finally, I want us to notice his courage in verses 7 to 11. Let's look first at his flexibility. Paul comes to Corinth and he meets these Jews, Aquila and Priscilla. And we read, because he was a tent maker as they were, he stayed and worked with them. See, the first thing, as we've noticed before, that an evangelist has got to do is to achieve an identity for himself which will give him acceptance and entry into the society he's trying to reach. Now at Athens, it had been easy. Paul had presented himself as a visiting lecturer. Such things were done in Athens, and Paul's academic training made it a fairly easy role for him to play. But you see, Corinth was a quite different matter. There were no professors here. How could Paul get in on things? Well, there was no problem. In academic Athens, Paul had been a lecturer. Well, in commercial Corinth, he would become a businessman. What could be more appropriate? It was as simple as that. Flexibility, assuming a role that fitted with where you wanted to be. I think there are a couple of lessons to us, very practical lessons, about our involvement in society and our Christian witness. I think there's a lesson, first of all, to those of us, and I know there are quite a lot here, who are students or academics. You know, by temperament and training, I'm quite sure Paul felt some reluctance to leave the university atmosphere of Athens. I'm sure, humanly speaking, he would have liked to have stayed in those corridors of learning, sharpening his mind in battle against those Stoics and Epicureans. I have little doubt he could quickly have established for himself a considerable reputation as a scholar and a thinker. But that was not to be. God does, of course, require scholars, but he's the God of all men, not just the intellectual, educated elite. And so he requires that all scholarship shall be put to the service of all men. He's no use for scholarship that remains incarcerated in its academic ivory tower, purely to satisfy the intellectual egotism of the scholar. That being so, it should be no surprise to us if sometimes he calls an academic out of the intellectual hothouse of the university town of Athens, where he feels no doubt so much in his element, and puts him into the marketplace at Corinth. Beware of overvaluing your education. You know, God has persistently fed the missionary endeavour of his church from the universities of the world. I don't suppose he intends to stop that policy. Pursuing an education in our early years, I have no doubt, is normally God's will for us. But it's by no means self-evident that God's will for us must be that we pursue formal education until we have accrued every certificate, every degree, every combination of letters after our name of which we're humanly capable. Education isn't an end in itself. No. Education is a preparation for the service of God and man. Yes, it must be for a Christian. It's not something to be enjoyed in a self-centered way, and if it ever becomes so, then it's become an idol that will hinder our obedience to Christ. God may call us, educated though we are, academics though we are, to the ministry of evangelism. He may require of us, as he did Paul, that we hang up our academic gowns, abandon the quietness of the library, leave the cool reasonableness of the common room, the mental stimulation of the lecture hall, so that he may send us, degrees and all, out into the real world where ordinary, non-intellectual people confront ordinary, non-intellectual problems in their ordinary, non-intellectual lives. And why does he do that? Why? Because, you see, ordinary people are the very people he intends principally to populate heaven with. Heaven, you will be relieved to hear, will not be full of the esoteric dissertations of university professors. Paul wrote to this letter in his letter to this church he was founding, "Consider your call, brethren," he says, "not many of you were wise by worldly standards. God chose what is foolish in this world." Well, now there's a lesson to all of our students and academics. Let it shatter our intellectual pride. God intends to have more Corinthian shopkeepers in heaven than Athenian philosophers. Something to think about. But I think there's a lesson too, a very practical lesson in this example of Paul's flexibility to all of us who are involved in business, in industry. You see, he was a tent maker and he worked with Aquila and Priscilla in a tent-making business. Now here we see something we haven't observed Paul doing before. Many Christians in business or industry use their work as an excuse for evading their responsibility as witnesses for Christ, I find. Many of them will decline to participate in the life of the church on the grounds that when they get home at night they're far too busy and far too tired. Many Christian businessmen and workers think that putting a large banknote on the offertory plate on Sunday is an adequate substitute for personally committed involvement in Christian service. Well, Paul shows us here that none of these things need be so, nor ought they to be so, and he shows it by personal example, doesn't he? There is nothing incompatible between earning your living in business and being active as a Christian evangelist. Or to put it another way, Paul is showing us here the feasibility and the value of lay ministry in the church. You don't have to be full-time to be useful for God. Indeed, our business life, far from being a hindrance to Christian service, could be an opportunity for access to lives that otherwise would be totally untouched. Now, those of you who are in work and industry, are you using that opportunity? And do your colleagues at the office or in the factory, your secretary, your typist, do they know you're a Christian? And if they don't, why don't they? Oh, you say, business and Christianity don't mix. Well, that's rubbish. If business and Christianity didn't mix, you'd have no right being in business, would you? Christianity isn't a little exclusive compartment of our life. Our faith invades and embraces everything we do. Of course Christianity and our business have to mix. But the truth is that all too often, the worldly scramble for promotion and success so dominates our mind that we're blinded to the opportunities for Christian witness that surround us in our everyday working life. We do compartmentalize our existence. Oh, you say Paul wasn't working for my company. He didn't have my boss. Well, no, there I agree, Paul was particularly fortunate. The business enterprise of which he became a part, God provided him in a most remarkable way with the ideal partners, didn't he? Aquila and Priscilla, who were quite evidently Christians. Christians before, I think, they met Paul, probably converted in Rome. Here then was an excellent situation, because the Christian sympathy and fellowship of Aquila and Priscilla must have made Paul's evangelistic task from this business base much easier, wasn't it? If his business partners had been non-Christians, he might have found it much more difficult to give as much time and energy as he wanted to his Christian work. Now that in itself is perhaps a caution to Christians contemplating going into business and industry. How seriously do we examine the demands which that company is going to place upon us? And then we consider joining them as employees. You know, there are some companies that suck the blood out of their employees, especially their senior executives. Christian who allows his career to consume his spiritual priorities is dreadfully astray. Remember Jesus' advice, you can't serve God and money. If we find our business getting in the way, then perhaps we ought to think very seriously whether we're not in the wrong business. Business and Christianity must mix. Maybe if we find they can't, we're in the wrong business, we ought to, like Paul, set up in partnership with Christians or opt for self-employment or something. But we must mix the two. That's a very important lesson here, I think, for those of us who work for our livings in industry or in business management. That's the first thing that I want you to notice, the flexibility of Paul and his evangelistic strategy. He was quite willing to take up a job and become a lay person, if you like, for the sake of the gospel. The second thing I want you to notice is the authority which he exercised even in the rejection of the gospel. Look at verses 5 and 6. When the Jews opposed Paul and became abusive, he shook out his clothes in protest and said to them, "Your blood be on your own heads. I am clear of my responsibility." There are two major sorts of barriers to the success of the gospel that we've encountered as we've read the book of Acts. One is the barrier of misunderstanding. How when you encounter a foreign culture, you find that there are ideas, presuppositions in that culture which are in many ways antagonistic to those of the Bible, and so it's hard to get the message across, and that prevents people from receiving it easily. We saw that at Athens. But here we're encountering a second and quite distinct barrier to the reception of the Christian message. These Jews were not the victims of a cross-cultural hang-up. No one was in a better position to understand the message of Paul than they were. They had a Bible, they worshipped the God of the Bible, they were waiting for the Messiah promised in the Bible. And yet when Rabbi Paul entered their synagogue announcing that this Messiah for whom they waited was Jesus, they opposed and reviled him. This wasn't incomprehension. They understood only too well what Paul was saying. No, this was rank unbelief. And that's a more intractable obstacle to the gospel than mere misunderstanding. Because it's not just a function of the mind, it's a function of the will. They did not want Jesus to be their Christ, these Jews. Just as Jesus himself experienced in his own ministry, the real barrier was not that the light did not reach men, but that when it came, they preferred the darkness. Now, how are we to tackle this sort of rank unbelief, this rejection of the gospel? Well, I want you to notice two things about Paul's handling of it. The dignity of his message, even in its rejection, and the dignity he bestowed on his hearers, even in their unbelief. First of the dignity of the message. Your blood be on your own heads, he says, I'm clear of my responsibility. See, when we're faced with men and women who will not believe, it's easy to make the mistake in our desperate desire to make them change their minds of compromising the message somehow, of watering it down, of adulterating it, of adapting it. Oh, you've got me wrong. You must be misunderstanding to be reacting in this abusive and angry way. Paul could have done that. He had the genius to construct some kind of Christianized Judaism, which might well have won the whole synagogue over. Indeed, Paul was quite clever enough, if he'd wanted to devise a Christianized Hellenism for the Greek and a Christianized imperialism for the Roman and a Christianized paganism for everybody else. And plenty of so-called Christian churches have advanced by precisely that kind of strategy in world history. But that wouldn't do for Paul, you see. As we've said repeatedly, Paul saw himself neither as a philosopher nor as a rabbi. He was an apostle, an eyewitness to Christ's resurrection and a direct recipient of Christ's revelation. So his message was not negotiable. It was a matter of life and death. Those who rejected it put their souls in jeopardy. This was no churlish threat that Paul issued in verse 6, your blood be on your heads, in a kind of resentful pique because he'd been insulted and slandered. No, your blood be upon your heads is the solemn consequence of what the gospel claims to be. We may reject the ideas of men with impunity because they're only opinions, but when we reject that which claims to be the word of God, we're staking our life on our decision, aren't we? The evangelist then is called not only to introduce men to heaven, he's called to warn men of hell. Jesus said, whenever you enter a town and they do not receive you, go into its streets and say, even the dust of your town that clings to our feet we wipe off against you. Nevertheless, know this, the kingdom of God has come near you. I tell you, it will be more tolerable in the day of judgment for Sodom and Gomorrah than for that town. The dignity of the message, even in its rejection. The gospel is not to be judged by man. It does the judging. It's an authoritative message. And even when men reject that message and revile the messenger, that authority must be asserted so that men may know the seriousness of what they have done. Paul doesn't apologize. There's no appeasement, no compromise. Your blood be upon your heads. And the same warning must be given to everyone here who is failing to hear the call of faith in Christ obediently. If you are lost, you must take the blame for it yourselves. The dignity then of the message in its rejection, but also I want you to notice the dignity he bestowed on the unbelieving hearer. You see, if the rejected evangelist overcomes the temptation to compromise his gospel, there's a further danger. He may be tempted to compromise his hearers. He may seek to bypass their hardened attitude in some way that undermines their dignity as human beings. One familiar way is to resort to emotionalism. If we can't get men to profess faith through a commitment of the will that involves their rational faculties, then we can try for a response deriving totally from the feelings. This is the difference between what's called hot and cold communication in advertising lingo. Another way is to offer psychological bribes to faith, promising children to the baron, examination passes to the student, jobs to the unemployed, things like that. There are many churches that try to grow that way. If Paul had been with us today, he might very well have been tempted to exploit some of the more sophisticated techniques of human manipulation that have been discovered by those hidden persuaders of our modern world. The subliminal advertisers, the behavioural conditioners, the brainwashers. After all, people have been converted from homo to perso by these methods. People have been converted from being dissidents to good communists by these methods. Why not from unbelief to faith? After all, we Christians know we're right. We'd only be doing it for people's good, wouldn't we? Well, if Paul did not compromise his message, neither did he compromise his hearers. He argued, he tried to convince, we read, he preached, he testified, he did so with perseverance every Sabbath. And when Silas and Timothy arrived, presumably with some financial assistance from the Macedonian churches, he gave up his business and devoted his whole energies to this task. But when, in spite of all his efforts, resistance mounted to crisis point, he looked for no technique, no new method of persuasion. Your blood be upon your heads, he said. Self-determination is part of our human dignity. God made man a creature who knows freedom and responsibility. And respect for that dignity requires that Christians may not join the ranks of those officious dictators of mass opinion who seek to control the world by indoctrination or psychological manipulation. We offer no bribes, we exploit no emotions, we use no dehumanizing techniques. Christians are committed only to policies of persuasion that are consistent with human dignity. And the awful consequence of that is that sometimes respect for human dignity requires that we allow people to damn themselves. Hell may be a dreadful thing, but you know, hell gives more dignity to man than the brainwasher does. Hell respects a man's choice. It accepts the sinner's refusal. It treats him as responsible. Your blood be upon your own head, it says to him. But the brainwasher of the 20th century doesn't give man the dignity of being punished for his crime. It seeks instead to reprogram him as if his mind were a lump of malleable clay to be moulded at will by those who know what's best for him. Hell may be a dreadful thought, but the men who suffer there are still men. Their self-determination was never usurped. They wanted independence of God, and they got it. Human dignity is respected in hell, which is more than can be said for George Orwell's 1984 world. Christian evangelists must be prepared to accept rejection, as Jesus himself was prepared to accept it. Oh, Jerusalem, he cried, killing the prophets, stoning those who have sent you. How often I would have liked to gather you as children, as a hen gathers her brood under her wings, but you were not willing. And he wept over that city. Paul knew such tears too for his own brethren, the Jews, who respected his gospel. The agony of the cross is reproduced in the evangelist's experience. He labored among them. He loved them. They were his own kin, but they rejected him. Because he loved them and because he respected their human dignity, he accepted their rejection. That hurts. But it's a hurt every evangelist knows, and it can no more be avoided than Christ could avoid Calvary. That's the second thing, then, I want you to notice. The authority of Paul, even in rejection of his message. And the third thing I want you to notice from the example of Paul in this passage is his courage. You see what God says to him in verse 9. One night the Lord spoke to Paul in a vision. "Do not be afraid," he said. See, Paul had been rejected. It would have been easy to slink cringing out of the city with his tail between his legs like a scolded dog. He'd been humiliated, he'd been insulted, he'd been hurt emotionally. And make no mistake about it, he was afraid. He knew that to stay in that city meant taking a risk for his physical safety. He had seen Stephen stoned, remember? He'd seen the Jews manipulate Herod so as to have James, the brother of John, executed. He had been personally assaulted more than once. The scars of his Philippi beating were probably still visible in his body. He wrote in his later letter to the Corinthian church, "I was with you in weakness and in much fear and trembling." You bet he was. But of course, unless you know fear, you can't be courageous, can you? And the man who faces battle with no trepidation at all is not a brave man, he's a fool. The man of courage is the man who stands in his ground in spite of his fear. In this situation of deep disappointment and hostility and potential danger, Paul needed to find such courage. And very graciously, I want you to notice how the Lord gave it to him. He gave it to him in three things. First of all, he gave it to him in some real indications of responsiveness among the people. See that in verses 7 to 8. There was this Roman, Justus, who owned the house next door to the synagogue. That's ironic, isn't it? You go out of one door and pop next door. He was so interested, this man Justus, he invited Paul to stay with him, and since Paul's continued presence in the house of the Jewish Christians, Aquila and Priscilla, was probably placing their lives in danger, Paul decided to take up the offer. And then there was Crispus, the chief elder of the synagogue, no less. He was converted with his whole family. Of course, he couldn't continue holding his post in the synagogue. We find in verse 17 that another fellow had taken his place there. But his conversion seems to have started a flood of interest among the Corinthians, and there were quite a number of baptisms. In fact, Paul mentions a number of them in the beginning of his letter to the Corinthians. After his rather barren time at Athens, this sort of prolific success must have greatly cheered Paul. This is often true in the way the Lord graciously deals with us, that when we are depressed on the point of giving up, feeling scared, he brings a harvest. He brings blessing on us. So that was the first way Paul was encouraged. The second way Paul was encouraged was by receiving from the Lord this definite confirmation that he was in the right place. Verse 9, "Keep on speaking, do not be silent. For I am with you, and no one is going to attack you and harm you." The very fact that God had to speak to Paul in this way shows just how much he was trembling. He needed a recommissioning, a new assurance of his call, and God gave him it. Sometimes our Christian lives go through phases like that. When we're deeply discouraged, we need a new vision. Perhaps we heard God's call to some kind of commitment many years ago. The strains and tensions of the Christian life have rendered that call faint and fading. And we are becoming afraid. Well, we don't have to be satisfied with that. We can seek God for a deeper assurance of his commission. We won't be able to stand for long without knowing that he stands with us. But the third thing I want you to notice, and notice most particularly the way that God encouraged Paul to stand firm in this hostile environment, was by a new consciousness of God's sovereignty in his evangelistic enterprise. Look at verse 10. "I have many people in this city." Now, I want you to notice the tense there. "I have" is a present tense. Literally in the Greek, "a great company are mine in this city." See what that implies, don't you? Evangelism is no haphazard, chancy business. Oh, I know, to us, bound by time, struggling to see results, the situation often looks bleak with discouragement. But the fact is, the results of our evangelistic labours are never in doubt, because God's people already belong to him. The evangelist is not in the business of creating the people of God. He is in the business of discerning who those people are. Many people suggest that a strong doctrine of God's election, God's sovereignty in evangelism, saps our evangelistic motivation. Oh, they say, why should we bother to preach the gospel if God already knows whom he intends to save? But that's a crazy logic. We see here in Paul's experience a truth that could be multiplied 1,000 times in the ministry of great evangelists. That often it's only the knowledge that God has got a people whom he intends to save that nerves our wills to go on preaching in spite of apparent disappointment. Paul had given his all in preaching and teaching to these Jews, and they'd rejected his message. What more could he do? If the conversion of sinners depended on his ability to persuade men, he had every reason to feel he was a failure. But you see, our ability to persuade is a very minor factor in God's strategy. For it is he who gives new life, he who gives the increase. Without his purpose to save, we preach in vain. God's choice of his people before the foundation of the world doesn't make evangelism unnecessary. It's the only thing that makes it effective. I have many people. Preach and do not be silent. It's logic like that that sent Carey to India, that sent Edwards and Spurgeon into their pulpits, that sent George Whitfield into the open air. And if we need to find courage to persevere in a situation that's depressing in its apparent barrenness, it's here that we will find it, in our assurance of God's sovereignty in salvation. These are the things that kept Paul there, that put iron in his backbone. You see for how long he stayed? 18 months. Amidst all that hostility, amidst all that fear, he stuck it out for 1.5 years, preaching the word of God, knowing that at any time he could be landed in deep personal danger. But he stuck it out, like farming on the edge of a volcano, because he knew the soil was good and that there were going to be results. Now I say here's a great lesson for us in courage. John Wesley once said, "Give me 100 men who love God with all their hearts and fear nothing except sin, and I will move the world." And we could emulate Paul's courage in that respect. Flexibility then. He was willing to take an appropriate role in the place where he was. He was willing to give up his academic gown, precious though no doubt it was to him, and become a businessman for Christ's sake. His authority, even when men rejected him, he didn't allow the gospel to be cheapened by their rejection. He gave dignity to the message and he gave dignity to them by saying, "Your blood be on your own heads." And finally, his courage. For 18 months, sticking it out in a very dangerous situation because God had said he had many people in the city. Let's pray together.